Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 182, entitled, How to Not Care What Other People Think and Turn This Into a Superpower, I chat with Ed Lattimore. Ed Lattimore is a physicist, army veteran, former professional boxer, and author of the book, Not Caring What Other People Think is a Superpower, Insights from a Heavyweight Boxer. In today's episode, Ed talks about his very interesting and eclectic life and the lessons he's learned over the years from being a heavyweight boxer, growing up in the projects, and becoming a physicist. He talks about the mindset and mentality for success he's cultivated through the years and gives us an up-close look into the makings of his many triumphs. Chief among his most precious attributes are Ed's abilities to tune out the opinions of those who don't matter and to separate himself from negative influences whilst dialing in on the things he truly cherishes. If you're wondering how to cultivate the talent to not care about what other people think and to focus in on what truly matters to you in life, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Hey, if you haven't checked out our Elite Life Nutrition products, go to EliteLifeNutrition.com right now and check them out today. We've got five powerful supplements, including magnesium citrate, calcium, ashwagandha, women's multivitamin, and our best-selling men's multivitamin, and we're unraveling so many more very soon. All Elite Life Nutrition products are made in America and manufactured in state-of-the-art facilities. We use the best technology in the world and the highest quality ingredients to ensure the products we make are precisely what you want. Look, I've been fooled too many times by supplement brands in the past, and I hate seeing so many great people like you without a reliable option of healthy supplements to go to. At Elite Life Nutrition, we've done all the research and all the hard work to ensure the very best supplements in the world. No more guesswork, no more crappy supplements, and no more not knowing what you get. Elite Life Nutrition has you covered. Go to EliteLifeNutrition.com now and order one of our products today. Also, if you've purchased one of our supplements and can leave a review on Amazon for us, we truly, truly appreciate it. It takes like 30 seconds to do and goes a very, very long way in helping us out. If you do review, shoot me an email and let me know. I'll be happy to send you a personal thank you note back. Also, let me know which products you'd like us to consider making in the near future. We're always happy and open to listening. My personal email is justin@elitemanmagazine.com. Again, shoot me a review and also shoot me some feedback as well on what you'd like us to consider making. justin@elitemanmagazine.com, and the website again is elitelifenutrition.com for all our incredible products. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is Ed Lattimore from EdLattimore.com. Ed, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thank you for having me, man. I'm always pleased when someone takes the time to listen to me blab on, you know?
Yeah, I love it. We were just talking for a few minutes beforehand, and you're a super interesting guy. That's why I wanted to bring you on the show. Man, your story is fascinating. It really is. I did some research into you. You have a book that came out fairly recently called Not Caring What Other People Think is a Superpower, which is a really interesting title, and I want to focus primarily on that in today's episode. But you're also a physicist, an army veteran, and a former professional boxer. So, dude, how do you have such an eclectic background like that? I mean, how do you go from boxing to basically doing what Einstein did, 70 years ago? How do you combine those two?
Well, I mean, Einstein, you know, pretty much rewrote physics, corrected some things we couldn't quite make sense of with Newtonian physics. But in terms of how all this happened, you know, and a lot of it happened within a 5-year period, is I felt like I had wasted a lot of time in my life in my 20s, and one day I just was like, you know, I'm smarter than where I'm at, and so I just dove headfirst and I enlisted in the Army so I could get some money to go back to school, and went back to school, and I'm doing this at the same time as my professional career in boxing is starting. I had boxed as an amateur for 5 or 6 years prior to that, and then everything was just kind of happening at the same time. And I didn't even go to school originally for physics. I originally wanted to be a mathematician. And then I went, and my MOS in the military exposed me to the basics of electrical engineering. And so I was going to go become an electrical engineer. And then I took a physics class, and I was like, wow, man, this is really cool. This is actually what I want to study. This is more like magic. Let me go do that. And that's, how that turned out. So if you want to look at, how it all happened, it's the rubber band effect. I had been pulled so much in one way, and that was the way of mediocrity. And I was like, all right, we got to fix this. So I went and fixed it all at once. And, looking back at it right now, especially the year 2015 and 2016, most of 2016, I have no idea how I did that. I couldn't tell you. I wouldn't choose to do it again, but I made it through, and really it's positioned me. I always say the best part about my degree, other than how it's made me think, the best part about my degree is that it makes people want to talk to me who would otherwise not want to, because I'm just a boxer. Likewise, the best thing about pro boxing, one is, one, getting out of it unscathed. I was set for a fight this year, and I withdrew because of some injuries, and for the first time in my career, I had suffered a concussion, and it was a pretty severe one, grade 2. I had a broken orbital and a fractured rib. And this is because I was just being foolish. Those injuries shouldn't happen in sparring, but they did, and it's largely my fault. And I just sat there, for a week recovering really in pain, because the first few days after concussion are the worst. And I just said, you know what? You're smarter than this. You're already making fine money from what you're doing online and from writing. Why? And, my coach actually had the same conversation with me the next day. And I said, I always said, if Tom tells me or even hints that I should probably do something else, I'll listen. And he made some good points. And so I'm really just finished. In May, everything changed. I finished boxing. I graduated from college. That freed up a lot of time.
Wow. So you just graduated from college and just got the title of being a physicist, or was it like...
Just got the so the title of being a physicist. So there's a I don't want to say it's a debate, but a clash of opinion, I suppose. What makes someone a physicist? Some people say it is having a physics degree, because that is not an easy degree to get. I can tell you, I did it, And then some people say, but you got to have some research at the PhD level. To those people, I say, you go get the undergrad and then talk to me. While I have not contributed anything new to the field, I just went and got an undergraduate degree. I still understand and know more than enough physics to know my way around any lab, textbook, things of that nature. And I get out there and I try and tutor so it stays sharp. But the point of me mentioning that is that, right, I feel comfortable saying I'm a physicist. And based on the scores I got for the national ranking test, I can't even remember what it's called, but we all have to take it when we graduate to compare what we know to other physicists who are graduating that year as well. I'm more talented than 62% of them. So there we go. Nice. That was the percentile I scored in.
Hey man, if you want to call yourself a physicist, I will never complain. It sounds like you make a good argument, but I wouldn't complain anyways, because you're a boxer professional. But no, it sounds like you're legit. And I'm just wondering how you dangle so many different things. Like, you have the professional box. I looked up your record too, 13-1-1. That's pretty solid. Yeah. I mean, that's really, and the majority of those wins, if I'm not mistaken, are by knockout or TKO.
Yeah.
That's pretty solid. How do you dangle that and getting a physics degree? And then, of course, you were in the military for a few years. And then, on top of that, which I didn't even really mention, you have your own blog, and you're writing books, and you're putting these blog posts. Like, how do you get all this stuff done, man?
We
all have the same 24 hours. What are you doing?
We all have the same 24 hours, and we all, but a lot of us sleep for 8 of them. That certainly is not what I did for almost a year. There was what's weird? It was like walking around as a zombie a lot of this time. And that's not good, because you need to be mentally sharp and physically sharp. So then I had to strategically choose where I was going to basically lose. Not so much in boxing, but I was like, okay, I know I have this many attempts out of grade and it's out of this much and this is worth this many points. Let me, you know, let that go and focus on this. And I know drilling's coming up. So, but I don't have a fight scheduled for a while. Let me take a week off from the gym. It was a lot of that kind of thing, right? And ultimately, looking back on it, I mean, I'm sure I sold myself short. You know, I probably wasn't as good of a boxer as I could have been. You know, whether my potential would have taken me further is you know, always up for debate. It's potential, but I definitely think that there was a trade-off. There had to be. You know, most boxers aren't in school, let alone in school for a physics degree. And likewise, I mean, I graduated with a 3-1, which is not bad for a physics degree at all. But I probably could have, you know, got higher. I only have one book out. Maybe I could have more. You know, I only have so many posts. There's trade-offs. I mean, and you have to remember this, is everyone sees the end result. And that end result was incredibly difficult. I had to retake two classes. One, I failed on principle. I just was out of my element. And the other, because I was exhausted. Because I couldn't, and so I wasn't going to class. You know, it was very difficult. It was not easy, you know. And like I said, I have no idea how I did it, and I would not do it again. I would not recommend that path to anyone. But it's rewarding. You know, at the end, you know, every day I'm sitting right here at my work desk, and I look over at my degree, and my degree hangs right underneath the time I was on the cover of the city paper because I was going to be fighting on TV. And these things remind me, you know, what's possible when you really decide to be something and push yourself. I actually been meaning to hang up. I got a few other degrees and awards, but and then just hang those up as a reminder. I mean, other guy, because the piece of paper really means nothing, and I don't even use it. That's the funny part. But and I can replace it for like I think $25, but it's symbolic of me changing my mind because I mean I was really on a path where I am now should not be. It's not the end result of the actions I was taking in my life, I would say from 20 to 27. And then I woke up one day and I said, nope, this has got to change. Otherwise, you know, I always quote that line from The Matrix or that there's that scene when Neo's about to escape and Morpheus and Trinity have him in the car and they're like, wait a second, you know, before you decide to go back to everything else, Trinity looks at him and says, you know, you've been down this road, Neo, you know where this goes and you know you don't want to be there. You know, I basically did something like that. And so that's how all of this happened. I needed to just pull and I just kept running, just put my head down. And I woke up one day with a degree in physics and a 13-1 boxing record.
What are you more proud of, your physics degree or your accomplishments in boxing?
Physics. Not even a question.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing, you know, and I've talked about this sometimes to other people. One of the things, and I'm going to talk to you about it now, right? I was a deplorable math student. I mean, I didn't have any confidence in mathematics. I didn't think I would ever do anything worthwhile because in my mind, you know, if you weren't good at math, you weren't intelligent. Like I was like, I'm kind of smart, whatever. I can pick up languages ish if I study and I can read and write, you know, basic things. But I had I had zero confidence and zero ability. I actually, for one of my speeches, I looked up my high school transcript and I was, man, you know how you think something is bad?
Yeah.
You look back and you're like, wow, I actually failed high school technically.
Wow.
And I totally forgot about this because this was like 15 years ago. But yeah, I had to go and take a now part of the reason why I failed is because of senioritis, and I probably gambled too much towards what I thought was acceptable to pass. But a lot of it, you know, looking at my grades in math in particular, that was not the result of me not trying to get senioritis. That was a genuine lack of ability from being set back, you know, where I grew up. And so when I decided to get a physics degree, that took a lot of facing things that I didn't think I could do. But I said, this is what I want to do. I want to be. And it wasn't originally for physics. I was like, I'll do math. And I chose math because when I was looking at the top highest paying degrees, when I was on track to try to get a job, they all had math in common. I think the top 15. So I said, okay, if I get a math degree, I'll be able to do one of those jobs. So I put a lot of time into sharpening my math skills and faced a lot of just imposter syndrome. I mean, it probably wasn't until this year, honestly, where I had a student that I was helping get ready for the Calc AP exam where I said, wow, I really know this. And that's 2 to 3 years into my degree. Or actually 4, because I graduated this year, you know. So yeah, man, it's not even a question. I mean, boxing is very difficult, and anybody who gets in the ring, I automatically respect. I don't care what their record is, because, you know, most people will never know what that's like to stand in a square against somebody else, and it's just you guys in there with your shirt off, two all vulnerable and exposed, and you guys are trying to hurt each other. That's difficult to survive. That's difficult to survive effectively 15 times. You know, people still die in boxing. Not as much as they used to, but it's probably still the sport that kills those people, right? But physics took a lot of me saying I want to be someone different. Boxing was just more like a way to channel who I already was.
Actually, not too many of the listeners know this, but I did amateur boxing myself for 2 years back in when I was 17, 18 years old.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Yeah. I'll say, you know what I always tell guys? I think every guy should take an amateur fight, at least one.
Yeah.
You know, whether you decide you have a taste for it or not, because, you know, there's a lot of people that don't have a taste for that, and you can't even blame them. We're literally designed, you know, this is how I always notice something wrong with somebody if they get in boxing. Because, you know, that goes so against what any organism's main objective is, to survive, to run away from pain, to put yourself in the ring. I mean, look, I mean, I granted for a lot of kids, it's the better alternative to their life, you know, how it could have gone any other way. But a lot of people, you know, myself included, I didn't need to get in the ring. I'm sure, and there's all kinds of things wrong with me, you know. So, but I can admit that, you know, if you can't admit what you are, you can't ever fix what you are, you know.
Absolutely.
I'm a big believer in that.
You know, you make a great point, too. I can look back, and I'm writing my next book, which is actually, it's already written. I'm looking on getting a publisher in the next couple months for it. But in the book, I actually reflected back on the reasons why I got into boxing in the first place. And yeah, I wanted to be tougher, you know, as a 17-year-old kid, who doesn't want to be tougher? Yeah, I wanted to be cool. Yeah, I wanted to get girls and, you know, have that kind of clout that goes along with being a boxer. But the real reason, like you just brought up, you touched on, is that there was something off with me. Mentally, I was insecure. Mentally, I had a lot of emotional pain and things that I didn't deal with. And for me, that was the way that I dealt with it. Like, I had these insecurities, and it was like, oh, if I can at least be, you know, good at boxing, if I can at least be tough, then
yeah,
some of that pain will go away.
You know said I mean? It. You hit the nail on the head, man. I mean, there was a lot of insecurity for me for lots of reasons. I mean, some of it self-induced, some of it a product of the environment I grew up in and the things that I endured and just the way I always felt like I was seen by people. Like we were talking about before the show, that natural aversion to like certain aspects of small talk. I mean, until I really polished and developed my personality, these things all come together into a perfect storm of insecurity, and it drives you to do things like, oh, how can I stand out? Oh, you know what I'll do? I'll go box. That's what I'll do. And it gives you a way to show that you're not some just shrimp, man, that you're not a loser. Really, I mean, that's what got me into the ring, is that I was dating a girl for 4 years, and I used to like bash against higher education all the time, which was silly because her mom is a professor, and she said to me one day, she goes, okay, college is stupid, well, what have you done for 4 years? And I was like, you're right, I'm a loser. I mean, she was right, I hadn't done anything. So I was like, let me put some sweat equity into some place that looks cool, you know. And so I went to the gym because I wanted to look like a bad guy, man. I wanted to be cool. I wanted people to look at me and go, that's not just a guy that drinks on the weekends. That guy's cool. Because that's always been my worst fear, is to just be seen as some basic average dude, even when I was below average, you know.
Well, so what age did you actually start boxing? And how many amateur fights did you have, by the way?
I started boxing, I believe my first fight was I was 23, and so that's, you know, that's ancient by
yeah,
boxing standards. And I, my record, ooh, I used to know this, but I think I've had almost 60 amateur fights.
Wow, that's a good amount of fights too for amateur.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, especially in this day and age in America, because just on a slight tangent, boxing is just not as popular as it was, mainly because if you're a great athlete, you get sucked up by one of the big four, you know, MLB, NBA, NHL, or NFL, you know. Imagine if LeBron James put on a pair of boxing gloves, man, come on. Like, no. But he's not going to, because there's no money in boxing. You know, he makes $90 million before he even dunks a ball in the NBA.
Yeah.
Why would you go do something like boxing? It'll never happen. So all the great athletes, all the girls who are great, you know, athletes, they end up other places. And so, you know, it's pretty easy for me to get into the sport, because, you know, 10 years ago, maybe I'm literally beat out of the sport, you know, but I kept winning and kept building a little confidence. And then eventually I was like, wow, well, I've come this far, I might as well go pro. I mean, that's pretty much how it worked.
How did you feel when you got into the fights? I know I always had a nerve. I mean, even in sparring, like our spars, I used to spar 2-3 times a week. Our spars were basically like fights. We'd go all out in our sparring matches. I was always anxious, though, before the fight, and then I would have, like, this nervous energy throughout it. I don't know if it was just me in particular. I mean, you had, you know, 10 times the career that I ever had or could have wished to had in boxing, but I don't know if it's just, like, the nature I had in myself or if everybody's different, but I'm curious to think, like, what your mindset was before every match, or even, like, sparring matches, amateur boxing matches. What were your thoughts, and how did you feel?
Sparring, amateur, none of that really bothered me, but I'll tell you that the one time there were maybe two or three times I remember being nervous, and they were all during amateur fights. And they were when they were worth something. When the fight was worth something and I thought there was a chance I could lose, that is when I fought the best. And there were a number of fights like that in my amateur career, at least especially at the end. When I fought a guy, Dominic Brazil, who's a great pro now, and he actually went on to represent us in the Olympics in 2012. I drew him at the National Golden Gloves in I think 2011 maybe, and I remember that was the first time I'd been in a ring with somebody who was 6'7". I'm only 6'1".
Wow.
And I know all the guys who aren't 6 feet are going, only 6'1". Nah, man. Look. Whatever your height is, imagine somebody big enough to where you have to look up. I mean, that's the difference. And I remember being nervous before that fight, but I said, you know, I got to go in here and fight my ass off. And I did, and I won, and it changed my life. Then I fought a few times in Los Angeles, and I was really nervous out there because a fight with the way I was recruited in the program out there, if I lost, then I would be sent home, and I didn't want to go home. I had finally felt like I was making some headway in my life, at least in the amateur boxing spectrum. At this point, college wasn't even a thought. And when I fought another guy who actually ended up becoming a world champion in the pros for a short while, Charles Martin, I fought him twice. The first time I fought him, I wasn't really nervous because I was significantly ahead of him ability-wise. The second time we fought, and Charles was like, I think he's 6'5", and he's left-handed.
Wow.
And I only won that fight by 1 point. It was it was the fight that eventually led me to win a national title as an amateur. So I was never nervous about getting hurt. And I don't think you last very long in boxing if you're worried about that, because here's something they don't tell you, or at least a lot of people don't know. Everything in boxing hurts. It just does it disrupt your central nervous system enough to make you, you know, drop down. But it's all painful. So if you're worried about getting hurt, you're not going to last very long because you won't fight effectively and you're going to take too much damage and all. What I was worried about was having my life changed, especially when it was dependent on boxing.
Yeah, you mean like financially, that kind of thing, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, every fight, like I had a promoter for a year. I was promoted by Rock Nation Sports, and every fight was just, it was a nightmare. Which is another thing. I mean, high stakes anything. I mean, you got to be a certain kind of breed. I can function in high stakes extremely well. I don't enjoy it. The people who enjoy it, I think those people go on to become superstars.
Yeah, you know, like the Conor McGregors of the world, that those types of dudes.
Who like they make it a stage, man, and it's just fun for them, and that's it's not fun. I mean, it really is always there's a saying. I think it was Amarillo Slim, maybe I can't even remember the guy's name, but another big Doyle Brunson.
Doyle Brunson, yeah.
Right. I think maybe he's the one that said poker is a hard way to make an easy living. Well, I modified that for boxing. Boxing is a hard way to make a hard living. There's no money in boxing. Even when I was signed by a big promoter, you know, I'm pulling in. I make more money now writing, and I have every month this year are selling than I did than I made in the highest month I got paid boxing, right? And that is, you know, that's not good, you know. Because I'm not like an international best-selling author or anything, or some kind of a business mogul. I just figured out a few things, but guys go to that because they don't have anything else, and I get that. And it's better to – I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I remember we were sparring one day, and the coach said something. He said, you know, because I guess some guys were getting rowdy. He said – he calmed down. He goes, you know, if you do what you would rather do in the street – they'll arrest you, but if you do it in the ring, they'll cheer for you. And that always stuck with me because a lot of that's a better alternative. You know, if you got to choose between the street life and the ring, you know, you go to the ring, you make it work. Because that's the other thing. Boxing is a poor man's sport. You don't see any kids, you know, from the suburbs coming to box. That's why all boxing gyms are in the inner city. And there's a joke, but it's really true, too, or there's a lot of truth to it. The worse the neighborhood, the better the boxing gym.
Yeah. Wow. That is true. You're right. Even people like listening that can't picture that or don't really know any boxing gyms near them, think of like the Rocky movies with Apollo Creed and his neighborhood in like Philadelphia. They go to
right.
Like, you know, tough neighborhood and there's all those tough fighters in there. And even like Rocky and his trainer are like out of place at first and they got to like fit in when they're training with Apollo. That's what we're talking about here. Those guys are badass and they breed the toughest fighters.
For sure, you know, because you got to be tough to even do it. And then it's a selection. Somebody said something to me about physics, about how it's a selection process for intelligent people. Where you select out people who already think they're smart and they go on. Boxing is the same way. People who get into the ring in the first place and stick around are already they're already cut from a different cloth. And then for them to excel, those guys are cut from a different stone, you know? It's not even the same material. Yeah. And the only way to select for that is you got to get them in the ring.
Yeah, that's it. That's the only selection process. It weeds out everybody else. But you bring up a good point, too, or you just reminded me of something. You grew up in a really tough neighborhood yourself. What was that like? What city was it again, by the way? Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh, PA.
Neighborhood like? It was one of the rougher ones in Pittsburgh, right?
I lived with my first 9 years of my life. I lived in the Hill District, which was, you know, it was a pretty rough project. And then they started tearing down parts of it. And we were still poor. So where we go, they moved us to another project across town. This one actually had literal gates to control the flow of people. It didn't really make a difference. And that was called Northview Heights Estates. That's how you know you're in a project when they have these super nice names, man. It's crazy. That place, you know, I haven't been back to it. I haven't laid my head down to sleep in a housing project since I was 18. I've been back occasionally and certainly no times in the last 10 years to pick up friends or some of our friends I had back then or if my sister was still hanging out there. But that place, you know, I'm really lucky. At the end of the day, I'm lucky and I recognize that, and I'm lucky for a few reasons. One, I never got hit with any stray bullets. You know, I had bullet holes in my door, man. Let's not live next to some crazy crack dealer that was always involved in nonsense. But I never got hit with any strays. You know, I managed to keep myself relatively invisible until I got to high school, and then I went to high school across town, and so I spent as much time as I could away from that place. But and keeping myself invisible really, really worked because it meant I didn't get into many fights. But I got into a lot of fights, though, because the school I went to was a feeder school for all the local, you know, terrible neighborhoods, mine being one of them. So I'm going to school, you know, you got hoodlums, from my neighborhood. You got white trash from the block down the way trying to compete and, you know, make themselves look harder. And then there's rival gangs. We were the first school, middle school, first school in the city that had metal detectors. It was a wild environment. But what you learn, though, I mean, I wrote an article about it, and it's true. I think about a lot of the ways I view the world now. And some of the things that come naturally to me and some of the things that I struggle with, and they are all a product of growing up in that environment. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a distrustful person, but I believe that everyone has the capability to look out for themselves at the expense of my better interest. I don't think that's a negative or a positive. I just think that's human nature. And that comes from seeing some of the things I've seen growing up. I will never, I think one time in a moment of weakness when I was like 19 and it was an older girl that liked me, I smoked weed like once or twice. I'll never ever, you know, do drugs because I've seen just the effect of them. And people talk about, oh man, well, you know, it's just weed. I'm like, yeah, you say it's just weed. I've seen a few cats get smoked over it, so don't tell me there's no violence associated with it. You just are used to dealing with it at another level, so you have a different perspective. And that perspective, once again, is not incorrect. It's just different from the one, you know, I have. I have no problem, you know, because, you know, I've seen it. I'm getting a little soft now. Like, I'll see some thugs. You know, I'll accidentally end up in a part of the neighborhood when I go, like, see a cousin of mine. I'm like, oh, shit, I got to go to the hood. I mean, it makes you just more humane, too, because now, I mean, I know how to open my mouth and just talk to the people who, the kind of people I grow up with, because, you know, it's like if you go to another country and you speak with an accent, they'll look at you like, well, obviously you're not from around here. The difference is what they do in those neighborhoods when you're not from around here versus, you know, if you go to like Brazil or something. So that's good. I know how to, I mean, I really feel like I'm an every man's kind of person. I can communicate with everybody, and I really try to focus on the positives. I mean, there was a lot of negatives, like very, very, and you got to remember how does one end up in the projects? I didn't just get dropped off there by a stork. My mom, you know, was a character, and, you know, you grow up dealing with that. You know, my father was around. Fortunately, I wasn't one of those kids, and I think that's one of the things that I had going for me that really helped. You know, my father didn't live with us. He lived in Philadelphia, but he was around, and he did his best to expose us to different things, and how it influenced my sister is up for debate. But it really showed me from a very early age that there's something more to my life than Mount Pleasant Road. That's the street I lived up on, I grew up on. And there's something more than just these people I see. And it really drove me, and I'm really grateful for that. And that's one of those things I had going for me that I'm lucky. I could have been, you know, I could have got a piece of crap for a father who was just like, boom, I'm out. But I didn't. And that probably helped my mom not be, that probably kept my mom from being crazier. She had, you know, some help and some assistance. And I went through this period too when I was like, I think from 18 to 22, 23, where I just got really, I was just angry. And I got angry at my mom because she used to hold over my head when I was a kid. She would say, because we liked our dad, she would say, you know, your father didn't even want us to have you. He wanted an abortion. And she would wave that over my head. And so one day when I was old enough before my dad died, I just straight asked him. I was like, is this true? He was like, of course it's true. We were broke. He didn't even like, step back. And then I just got, and that was like one of the things and other things. And then one day it reached a boiling point, reached the head. And I was like, why did you have us? Like, And I tried to use that. I blamed such of my you know, inadequacies and deficiencies on that. And that probably set me back 5 years of my life. I was just angry and I didn't want anything to do with my mom. And, you know, now I don't think about it. I mean, now I understand. My perspective now is given how she was brought up and how she was raised. She did the best she could with what she knew. And she certainly, you know, never put us in danger. And then on top of that, I focus on some of the positives, because no situation is completely negative, right? It's just how you see it. Some of the positives, I mean, I walk around, I still believe, you know, I still think it's a sin to throw away a book. We didn't do that in my house. You know, books are treasures, which she always said, and it made me, you know, want to be a voracious reader of that sort of thing. And pretty much, I mean, she was crazy, but she never took our side. She never took a side against us if, like, the school was against, you know, if we were in trouble. So there's some positives. I mean, but there's a lot of negatives.
Yeah, I think growing up in an environment like that definitely shapes you in a lot of good ways. Of course, there are some negatives too. Like, you know, like you said with your mother, she had some negatives and she had a lot of positives. Everything has two sides to it, but you definitely seem like you took away a lot from growing up in that environment, a lot of good things. Your work ethic comes to mind, the drive. A lot of people have things in life that shape their drive for the future success that they have. It's like, you know, if you grow up kind of poor, if you grow up without any money, you grow up in the back of your mind, you have that unbelievable ambition to have, not necessarily money, but that's just one example, to have money later in life, to have a lot of things, to have that success that you didn't have as you were a kid. When you see, like, say, your mother or your father didn't have a lot of money, oftentimes those things later in life are the fuel that you have that 99% of the other people out there don't have because they didn't have that when they were younger in their environment. So it's like little things like that you don't necessarily learn or realize right away are the things that shape you into being incredibly successful later on because you have these different things that, you know, you didn't have when you were younger.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny you say that. I was just talking to a good friend of mine today, and I was saying, I was like, you know, and he wasn't as bad as me. He and his mom actually got things together, but he started that way. And I said, you know, the worst thing to happen is not being born like us. The worst thing to happen is being born middle class. Because all you're going to know is safety and security, and you're never going to venture out outside of that, even when you should. And you see it in every part of a person's life, not just the financial, but even the dating and athleticism and working on themselves. I mean, anything that is a risk, i.e. not a guaranteed return, you know, I find that people from a more middle station in life, especially if they grew up that way, they are averse to taking the risk. Meanwhile, I mean, I know what it's like. I'd rather not go back to it, but I know that I want more, and the only way to get it is to go after it. You know, that's just part of living. And at least that's just part of living for me. And that seems so obvious, but I recognize one of the reasons that seems obvious is because I've seen the bottom. I mean, obviously it could be worse. I mean, I could have been 2 years ago, we were down in the Dominican Republic, man. These cats didn't even have floors. Then that put it in perspective. Yeah. You know, there's American poverty and then there's poverty, right? I grew up in American poverty, and I'll be the first to say it could have been worse. But I won the lottery and was born in America. So yeah. With that said, you know, still, when you get into the middle, you know, you don't have that drive. You don't have that hunger. That's what it is. You want to maintain equilibrium. You're not interested in disrupting things and pushing further.
Yeah, I think you touched on a good point there. And I think it is a big problem, especially with the millennial type of generation, which I fall into. I think you might even fall into still. I'm not exactly sure what the numbers are on them, but it's typically the younger, you know, the 20-year-old, the younger 20s, those types of people that I'm referring to. There is a problem there, especially middle class, over-entitlement, that type of thing where they owe them stuff. There's a big problem in this country going on with that, and I think the more people, those types of people have to recognize that before they fall into a trap of, you know, spending the next 30, 40 years of their life with that mentality, because it's a recipe for disaster and failure.
Yeah, you know, I've got, that's one thing, man. I've got zero entitlement in my life. There's just that won't happen. I mean, you know, millennials, man, that's a funny distinction, because millennials are like, let me make sure I get this right. It's an 8-year span from like 83 to 91. And the problem is the world changed so much for those people who would have been born there, that you could have been born, you know, let's say like 86 to 83, and your high school experience is completely different than someone who was born 87 to 91. You know, it's not even, and I may not even have those numbers like completely correct. I think, but yeah, I was talking to someone about this on Twitter a few weeks ago about how you know, the millennial gap is just too wide because of how quickly the world changed technologically. Like, I mean, no one had a cell phone when I was a senior in high school. Social media wasn't a thing, and you know, 4 years later, I'm behind because I don't even have a freaking Facebook or a cell phone. How'd that happen? You know, behind.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. Like you said, just in like maybe a 5 year period after. I remember being in high school too, and cell phones were basically still new. Like a bunch of my friends had got we'd had cell phones in high school, but we didn't have like the smartphones, and they were still fairly new. The texting was like, you know, you press the button like four times to hit a letter. It was like that type of thing.
Oh yeah, man.
But even when I was in middle school, I remember like if a friend had to call or get in hold of me, they had to call my house, and then I'd have to call their house back, and it was like, you know, that thing.
Oh yeah,
that was for years.
Payphones. Yeah. Remember you couldn't be on the internet and a phone at the same time.
Yeah,
and then DSL was a big thing. Oh man, now DSL is a slow like a joke. Your cell phone is faster. But so, and that's not within that, and that's on 3G, you know, so
yeah
just a different world.
Have you joined the Elite Man newsletter yet? If not, get on it now. Go to EliteManMagazine.com/newsletter and sign up to get special Elite Man content not seen nor heard anywhere else. Get all of our bonus podcast information, sneak peeks into upcoming shows, behind-the-scenes content, special offers, and exclusive Elite Man updates you won't find anywhere else. I'm telling you, if you're not on our newsletter, you are absolutely missing out. Go to EliteManMagazine.com/newsletter and become a true member of the Elite Man community right now. I look forward to speaking to you soon. EliteManMagazine.com/newsletter. Ed, you know, you brought up the fact that a lot of people in your neighborhood were some bad dudes, some bad people. I'm sure a lot of your peers fell into the trap of getting into drugs. I know a lot of my friends that I actually grew up with are either dead, they're in jail, or they're not doing well. Not all of them, but a good amount, an amount that you would be surprised at, like just how many people fell down that path. What separates you, or what separated you from not going down that path and getting into drugs, getting into crime, and just, you know, completely changing your life around?
What separated me? Well, here's a big thing. I, for whatever reason, man, I just met up with a friend of mine because I'm doing this project where I'm interviewing prisoners, and we grew up, and he went a completely different way. He ended up, I mean, I don't know if high ranking is the best way to say this thing, but a pretty powerful member of the drug delivery systems in our city, and we were just talking about this after he got his life together.
Illegal drugs or?
Oh no, illegal drugs. No, okay. He was a crack and heroin dealer. Okay. Very illegal, but he asked that very question. We started talking about it, and he goes, one of the things, you know, we were very similar, but what separated you from me is you never cared to be liked, or you accepted just kind of being an outcast, and I never accepted that. I never wanted to just be an outcast. I wanted to be liked by these people, and that really stood out to me. And I thought more about it because it's not like I never wanted to be liked. I mean, that's one of the things that led to me drinking a lot. But what happened is I always say one of the best things to happen to me is when I was 14, I went to a high school across town and with a completely different social economic, you know, makeup of the student body. And I was a victim of positive peer pressure. These are people that encouraged me and pushed me, and I wanted to be like them. That's who I wanted to be like. Because my dad had exposed me to just different ways of living. And I didn't quite make the connection, but I knew that these guys weren't going to get that. I knew those guys who were in the streets. I'd seen people who were three, four generations still in the same project. I knew that wasn't where it was at. On top of that, my mom terrified me one day about prison, and I didn't want to go to jail, and I knew that was also a possibility. Funny though, he said a few times, he said, you know, for me, I just figured I was gonna go to jail one day. It was just a matter of when. But I was like, nah, man, you're not gonna get me in a shower. That's not gonna happen. So I mean, these are little things that you know, piled up. I let myself get hooked on video games as a kid. It was better for me to spend, and my mom didn't see this. And this is an interesting conflict we had. I tried to explain to her several times, there's nothing out here for me. Just let me sit in my room and play Final Fantasy Tactics. She couldn't grasp that. So we went to war quite a bit about this. Ultimately, I don't know if she got smart or she gave up, but I was able to really retreat to my room a lot of times and just keep away. Because, you know, part of being who I am, you know, I've always been an intelligent guy. I just didn't have the mathematical aptitude. I had to develop that. But even if I, you know, didn't have that, I still was me, and I spoke and carried myself in a certain way, even amongst all these kids, and that made me a target for bullying. The thing about bullying in these schools, man, I don't. Before I go any further, I don't know what bullying is like in a nice, well-to-do school. I can only say that I'm sure it wasn't worse than what I endured, which was a lot of fighting. My coat in the middle of the winter would randomly end up in the toilet multiple times. It was a miserable, miserable time, but I never felt pressured, and this is the big point. I never felt like this was a group of people I wanted to belong to. And a lot of other people did. You know, I never was like, these guys are gonna be me, because it wasn't me. I mean, even now, that's not me. I like, you know, my idea of a good time. It's funny how your personality stays kind of the same once you are true to yourself. My idea of a good time is some live music in a museum, man. Like, I'm just not, I'm just not a flashy, I need to be the center of attention kind of guy. Now, I don't like to blend in with the crowd. I mean, if I'm going to be with a crowd, it's either for me, like my birthday, or I'm teaching or something. But other than that, I mean, yeah, it never drew me in. And I'm really grateful that not only did it not draw me in, so that, you know, there's that genetic lottery, but eventually my mom relented and did not force me to socialize with these people. You know, I had two friends that I had from the projects. One, I don't talk to either of them anymore. So for all intents and purposes, I don't have a life before I was 14. You know, but I have a cousin that I'm good friends with. But then I and those two friends, you know. Well, one moved and lives in Atlanta, and I like connected with him like 10 years ago. But the other one is still in the projects. He's got like three kids with three different girls. Because eventually we just went separate ways. I mean, so even the people that I did find weren't, they wanted to be a certain way, and I never wanted to be that. I never wanted to be like the people around me.
This kind of seems like it geared you for your decision later in life to, well, A, stop drinking, and then B, really stop caring about what other people think, which actually became the basis for your book by the same name. When did you come up with this concept? When did you break, well, first, when did you break the habit of drinking, and how did that come about where you realized you had to stop drinking? And how did you actually implement some of these teachings that you talk about in the book where you just stopped caring about so much about whatever people thought?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the, what led to me a lot, I mean, there are many things that contribute. The things that I've identified as yeah, man, we got to go drink, like the major motivators. One, I really was not, and I'm still not a hang out at the bar, just talk for hours about nonsense and stupid stuff that I find, you know, inconsequential or boring. But you know, that's what the girls were, so I had to figure out how to make that work. So I drank a lot, and really, man, I was numbing myself, man. I didn't wanna. That's how I felt like I had to feel good. I mean, I remember when I was living in LA and it was like really starting to pick up. I was drinking a lot by myself because that's what I associated with a good time. As far as when I stopped drinking. you know, I enlisted, and when I enlisted, you know, through basic training and AIT, there you can't drink. I managed to sneak one drink at AIT, right? Because it's easier. And then I got home, I went out for a party, and I got smashed and didn't remember how I got to my buddy's house. And I was like, okay, here's the deal now. Now we've got a goal, because remember, I enlisted to go to school, and I was like, you know, I felt like this was my last shot. Now, under the jurisdiction of not just the penal code of the United States, or rather the judicial code of the United States, but the UCMJ, the Universal Code of Military Justice, right? So I was like, okay, then that's getting hit twice for something you did once. And I just met my girl, and I thought, okay, this is a really great person. I said to her a lot of times, I still every now and then joke with her, I always say, you know, either you're the best actress on the planet, or you're the real deal, right? And I really felt that way. I mean, I now I'm confirmed. I mean, I think she's, you know, as close to the real deal as any girl can be. But, like, I had all these things really going for me, and they were lining up. And I was able to step back and look at my behavior and go, okay, alcohol kept you down for so long. Are you going to fall into that and let it ruin things now? Are you going to end up, you know, getting maybe a DUI and losing all your money for school and getting kicked out the army? Are you going to end up, you know, being out? Are you going to be out for having a few drinks and end up, you know, picking up some girl that you don't really want and ruin your relationship? Are you going to piss some of the people off that are starting to respect you for what you did in your life? And I just looked and I said, you know, I got to step away and I got to be a better person. Like, because I wanted to be a better person, because I didn't like who I was, you know, and this is the honest truth. I didn't like who I saw in the mirror. It was very, and this is another thing that led to a lot of the drinking when I was alone. I mean, you really start hating your own thoughts and the way you see the world and the way you see yourself. And I was like, all right, I want to be better than that. I don't want to just be this guy that drinks. I don't want to be known as that. So that's what pushes me. As far as how that influences the book is a collection of the areas where I had to change my thinking. And it, you know, the chapters break down. I had to see the world a different way, paradigm shift. There was the hard work. That's the biggest chapter in the book. There was my relationships. That was a significant, not just romantic, but platonic as well. Because, you know, you got to rebuild how you work with friends. Because before, your friendships and your relationships you were trying to build were based on this person you were presenting. Now you got to focus on who you are and let people take it or leave it. That's hard. That is not easy. That's why very few people do it. And I got a section about using your time and working with sobriety and building confidence as well in yourself. In other words, all these areas, you know, when you focus on how you're perceived, you're very outcome oriented, and you'll do things that may be dubious or short-lived that are not necessarily going to get you any closer to the idea you have of yourself. And if you have any respect or any sense of self, you know, you have to start focusing on the process. Once you focus on the process, you know, whoever takes it, whoever does, but you're getting closer to what you want to be, because you're not worried about being what other people want you to be.
So in your mind, was there a certain set of goals that you came up with that you had to internally focus on so that you didn't really get distracted by the outside noise?
Yep. And you know, it's funny you ask about those goals, because at one point, because you know, you got to give yourself, you got to put some cheese on the trap, man. You got to dangle the carrot in front of the donkey, man, to get them to move. I was not confident in my ability to stay sober. So I said, all right, dude, this is not permanent. How about, you know, once you get your degree, you want a belt, or you write it, or you publish a book, then you can drink again. Well, as time went on, I was like, I'm losing my taste. I published a book. I'm like, well, I'm not going to drink now. I got a whole section there about sobriety. Let me chill out. I got my degree. I'm like, oh, I really don't want to drink now. I got my degree. Yeah, I'm not going to undo that. And now at this point, I'm talking about the next book I'm going to come out with. It's all about dealing with sobriety. And, you know, I'll never win a belt in boxing because, you know, as it stands now, I say as it stands now because you never know. But that's probably just my ego talking. you know, I'll never box again. So really, the goal, the three goals though that I did focus on was making my writing as good as it could be, and as honest as it could be, and getting my degree and doing as well as I could in boxing. I immersed myself. If for the first year, I don't think I saw anyone but my girlfriend because we lived together. I don't remember much. It was a blur of work, but I came out of it and I was like, man, I'm so much closer. And, you know, it just felt good. And I was like, all right, well, this is a lot better than getting drunk. Cause I talk about this in my article about, you know, 2 years of sobriety. I'm on almost 5 years now. But I say, you know, a lot of us use alcohol not just to numb the bad, but to, you know, kind of like exaggerate the good, right? But what that does is that numbs you to your actual ability to feel things. So I was like, all right, you know, this feels good. I said to her a few times, you know, if I was still drinking, I'd go for a drink right now. But I wasn't. And so I learned to enjoy life again, man, like the way I want to enjoy life. And it's a good feeling, but those goals really helped me.
Yeah, it's funny, too. You said, like, you kind of locked yourself in your house for a year and only saw your girlfriend. We mentioned before we went live, actually, that it's kind of a crazy thing that people like you and I do. Like, we get so immersed with our work, and then we have to try to find, like, that balance between work and social and having everything flow. But sometimes it's okay to do that. Sometimes it's actually good to cut out all the other stuff, the distractions, all the noise out there, and really focus on yourself and what you're passionate about and getting that done. I mentioned, too, also the story of Elon Musk, who I heard, I forget from where the source was, but he basically is one of the busiest guys in the world. He has so much going on, one of the most successful entrepreneurs out there. But he often has times relating to other people and socializing with other people because he is so focused on his work. So there is like a fine balance that you gotta tune into. Like, you can go through your times of working nonstop for a year straight and getting like books done and, you know, the blog set up and everything else. But I think you do have to come back at some point. How have you been able to figure out that balance?
You know, aside from being a natural extrovert, in other words, it's always harder, for me to stay away from people than it is to stay with people. What I've learned to do, and I do this very well now, is I socialize on my terms, you know, and it's really easy because, you know, I don't have to worry about, like you could have your kids socialize with me because everything I do is nice, PG, and above water. I'm not at the bar. I'm not out being a fool. You know, I don't like most loud music, man. Like, it's just not. So I'm a very relaxed kind of guy, and I really enjoy the conversation. So I got rid of a bunch of people who had just kind of straggled into my life, and some of them got rid of themselves. I mean, but and that's a conversation in and of itself. But now I really am about the quality and not the quantity. I mean, I sit with my friends and I talk and I learn about them. We get coffee. In other words, you know, I make the interaction about the other person as opposed to I want to have an excuse to drink. Why don't you join me? Which is what a lot of it boiled down to when I was drinking. You know, I think one of the biggest wasted times we'd have is, you know, let's meet up for drinks. Like, nah, man, I can drink by myself if I want to drink. if you want to kick it, you know, let's grab some coffee, man. Play a game of chess. See, let me learn about what's going on in your life. So I've really focused on the quality of my friendships. And I don't care so much about it. I mean, really is the quality. And then the people I meet, I make sure that I do something in my life that forces me to be around people. Like right now, it's tutoring. I love tutoring different families' children in calculus or math or science, whatever, right? And when it wasn't tutoring, it was boxing. The boxing gym, even though it's a solitary sport, there are a lot of people at the boxing gym, and you form relationships with these people, and they really become like your family. So while it would be easy, very easy, for me to just sit in my den and work and not worry about anything, I can't live like that because here's the litmus test, just so you can you can see what this is, what this will be like. Imagine achieving all of your goals, right? Or a really important one, the biggest one you have on the you know, the bucket list. And you go to celebrate, but you don't have any friends. Your phone's empty. Your social media is kaput. No one knows. No one cares. And that feeling you feel when you think about having no one to talk to about what you've accomplished, that is the importance of people. That is. So I know what that's like. So I don't want that. You know, when I lived in L.A., that was one of the hardest things. Because when I got shipped to L.A., that was a surprise, right? I know everyone thinks L.A. is fun. Nah, man, any place is fun if you got the right mindset. I didn't have the right mindset. But I spent a lot of time out there by myself because I had a suspended license. And, you know, I went out there with a suspended driver's license. Not related to alcohol. I didn't pay a ticket. That's what happened. And if you've ever been to L.A., man, you can't live in Los Angeles without a car. Certainly not in Carson, which is one city above Long Beach. And I just hated. I mean, I would win fights, and I'd be like, "Oh, who am I gonna go celebrate with? Oh, I have no one to celebrate with." So I would walk to this bar by myself and drink, and that was stupid. I think about that those experiences, and I go, that is what it's like to not have people, and people are so important. You always gotta have somebody in your life, you know. And you know, she can decide to leave whenever she wants to, so I gotta make sure I have friends. You know, I think that's key to a relationship, to always, you know, kind of look at it and go, you know, well, what would I do? I ask myself this all the time. I go, what would I do? How would I react if she came home and was like, you know, we gotta talk? I'd be like, all right, well. And you play that out, and then you go, all right, well, I'd be sad, but be all right in like a week or two, you know, whatever. And you know, we say that to ourselves, more like a year or whatever. But the point, though, is that you need relationships.
Yeah, it's a huge point, too, and often overlooked. And I think it's something that, unfortunately, is, like we talked about earlier, the millennial generation, that type of thing, texting all the time, virtual connectedness that takes that replaces actual face-to-face or physical in-contact connection relationships. Unfortunately, I think it's a dying skill that most people don't have anymore, or they're lacking and starting to lose. So it's something that you actually actively have to go out and work on. How do you take the idea, the concept of not caring what other people think, but also, on the other hand, building those relationships? It almost seems like it's the opposite of one another, but you know what I mean? Like,
I know what you mean.
There is a balance there, and there is a way to make it work, and actually to improve the relationships by contrastingly not caring so much about them.
Right, because ultimately, look, I mean, it's a painful thing we're all going to have to go through, or hopefully we all go through, unless we're really lucky and we just happen to come into this world in this perfect state and form our relationships this way. But you're going to develop into a person, and the other person is going to develop into a person, and those two people will not be compatible very often. We see this a lot with people who are circumstantial friends from like high school or something. It's like, oh goodness, not a, we don't have this commonality bringing us together. Do we even like each other? That kind of thing, right? When you don't try to make yourself likable, and I'm not saying maybe be dislikable. What I'm saying is don't go out of your way to appear to like things or be interested in things, because someone else is, you know, what you're going to do is you're going to accelerate the first process we spoke of shedding the old people, but then you're going to find yourself in a crowd of people who are more like you, who you feel comfortable with, and they feel comfortable with you around. And that's good for everybody. The old situation is not good for anybody. So what it comes down to is really having faith and believing in, you know, the way you think, see, whatever, and then seeking out people like that. I mean, you don't want to – obviously there are there are like social necessities, whatever, there are niceties that you have to obey and oblige. I mean, no one's saying be an a-hole, but at the same time, you know, if I like rock and roll to the point where it's part of my personality, and you like classical to the point where it's part, you know, part of your personality, you know, we probably should split ways. And that's just the superficial idea. But I'll give you one more, like, serious and more relatable, perhaps. I don't know. I have always been this guy who wanted to eventually live abroad and be this guy who would eventually, you know, adopt or foster children. I understand that's not a popular position, especially, you know, in this, at least in our country. I don't know. Well, it's like, oh, you want to have your own or whatever. Someone actually said that to me one day. And I was like, but I knew that was a rare position. And one day we were talking, me and I just, you know, started talking about it. And she's like, and she gets this, I think her eyes turn to hearts or whatever they do. And she's like, oh, I've always wanted to adopt children too. That's been like my goal. And right. Imagine if that was like a serious point of contention. Like, and in romantic relationships, this is easy to see because, you know, we kind of are under the gun in the way we're exposed to one another. So we get to see, you know, where we're different and where we're similar way faster than we do with just casual friends a lot of the times. And so I was just being me. I mean, I'm assuming she's being her because I know her background and what she's done. So I'm like, so it works. There's no, right? There's no compromise or whatever. No, on the other end, you know, she hates horror movies. I love horror movies. You know, so we don't watch horror movies together. It's never going to happen, right? And like, well, some of my friends, I mean, there are some friends where I probably, they're all good people and we come together, but they don't force, no one forces their lifestyle upon me and vice versa, you know, which is one of those things I was worried about when I stopped drinking. I was like, I texted my closest friends. I got six of them or so. And I said, yeah, man, I'm done. I understand if you don't want to hang out with me because I'm scared at this point and I still have this mentality like they're going to worry about that. But they're like, no big deal. And it hasn't been. You know, they recognize that I'm just busy in my own world and I link up and see them when I can. But a lot of people are like, you know, but it's amazing how many people I did lose touch with because I didn't drink. And I hear this all the time from people who decide they want to stop drinking, they lose a lot of their friends. So ultimately, you know, to stay on topic and stay on point, you can't modify who you are to fit a group. And when I say that, what I mean is you can't become something you feel internally stressed, where you feel tension. Like, I don't like that. I don't want to do that. I just do it to hang out with these people so I don't be lonely, you know. I'll tell you what, it's better to be alone than it is in mismatched company. I do believe that because every moment you're in mismatched company is a moment you take away from possibly meeting better company, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it. You make some really great points. How has this become a superpower for you? Because that is part of your book, it's really kind of the hook of the book, or at least the title, and it just makes it a lot more interesting, I think. How has this become your superpower, not caring so much about what other people think?
You know, I've lost some friends over some stupid things, and I'm like, all right, cool, it was good being your friend. I don't go out of my way to be like, I'm not a troll or anything on social media. That's not my style. I'm very much like what natural part of my personality. I want to help and deliver what I've learned through life. And if you take it, you take it. If you don't, you don't. But that seems to work because my method of speaking, you know, is growing. I have 53,000 followers on Twitter. And, you know, when you're smart about that, you can turn that into a revenue source. But the point, though, is that this authenticity of mine has weeded out anyone from my life who would not work anyway. It has made me a very happy person. You know, I said the other day to somebody, or maybe it was a few weeks ago, I said, I haven't had a bad day in 5 years. That doesn't mean I haven't had a hard day, but I haven't had a bad one because because how can I have a bad day? I don't. I have it set up. My space is so polarizing who I am, because I'm not working to fit anyone's preconceptions or expectations. I'm working to fulfill what is important to me. I can't have a bad day. Every day I do that. But you can only have a bad day if you don't meet someone's expectations, or you don't meet your own. You know, and my expectations are such that I either try to meet them every day, or I do meet them.
Ed, just kind of wrapping things up in a moment, what are a couple, like, two or three action steps that you can give guys right now listening to help them not care so much, not be so invested into what other people think of them, into maybe fitting into crowds, into trying to be that cool guy that you and I tried to both be as, you know, when we were younger? What are a couple action steps, couple takeaways that they can do right away to step away from that sort of mentality and step back into the one that you've cultivated?
Well, you have to remember that what's the old joke? There's groupies for everything except World of Warcraft. I bring that up to say that there's somebody out there for you in everything, and that really is something I wish I had realized early on, that I would have been so much happier if I had just spent some time not necessarily trying to ingratiate myself to a group, but rather, you know, work on me and whoever I get surrounded by. So the action step I give based on that is you have to just do what makes you happy. Whatever your weird drive obsession is, you know, assuming it doesn't hurt anybody or cause any harm, you know, do that and find a community for it. We live in a beautiful time. You can find a group for everything. Things you shouldn't be able to find groups for, you can find. You know, so yeah, no excuse for spending one more second around people who make you feel like you, as you are not adequate. That's the number one thing. On top of that, you know, and this may sound like it's going to run somewhat counterintuitive, and I suppose at the purest academic level it does, but in application it does not. You need to work on building up the parts of yourself, you know, some base parts of yourself. You know, be healthy, have people you care about. Make sure you're in the best shape. Make sure you start to, you know, you do want to care about how you present yourself to the world, only because there are certain preconceptions that are going to work counter to you. I don't care how comfortable you feel. You just shouldn't walk around with a white shirt that's covered in ketchup stains. That's just not going to work well for you, no matter what you want to do. So that brings me to the next action point. Make sure that you present a polished face to the world, because that polished face, at the end of the day, you can't change people's preconceptions. You can't change, or rather, you can't change how people take the first impression. So go out of your way to make sure you make a good first impression, and then, you know, they can decide if they want to stick around or not. But you don't do yourself any favors. I mean, what if the people who work best for you in a situation that works best for you, you are keeping yourself away from because they look at you and go, man, you look like you smoke crack. Like, that's not going to work for anybody. So there's that. So love who you are and find that group that loves who you are too. And with the internet and social media, and even if we didn't live in that age, man, just get out and find those people and work on presenting yourself to the world as such that you don't, that your appearance is not actively working against you, because you have to work. You know, I hear so many people complain about, oh man, been judged before I open my mouth. I'm like, it's because you look like a fool. You don't have to, like, you don't have to look like a GQ model, but you should not look like you crawled out of the homeless shelter. You know, there's a middle ground.
I mean, like anything, there is a balance there where it's one thing to say you're not going to fall for the trap of trying to please people and trying to kiss their ass or be like them. but it's another thing to say you don't care completely, where you just, you know, get up out of bed and have your slippers on and your red stained white tee and you hop out thinking.
Because at some point, there's not caring what people think. And when I say that, I always make sure I clarify that. I mean, you don't want to worry about your outcome, the outcome to the point where you neglect the process. With that said, you know, there is, or rather continuing from that, if you don't care how you present yourself to the world in general, it won't matter what process you're working on, because that process will never serve its purpose, which ultimately is, you know, one, to fulfill you, two, to connect you to other people. I do believe that, but I believe in the right connections based on authenticity, not a collection of superficial connections based on, you know, oh man, who likes this sports team? I can't believe how much time I spent in bars about sports. Goodness, I hate that food. I don't even care. I mean, I like football. It's like, but I can watch any game. I mean, I don't really care. I don't want to waste all Sunday watching football. But I did sometimes. I thought that was cool. So,
I'm the same way too, man. As I get older too, I find I spend less time watching SportsCenter and watching all the highlights of all the games. Like, I got my team. I got my Pats.
man. I'm a hate I get here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
But I'll say this, right? It's not so much that I'm a Patriots fan, because I think it's very hard to be a fan of a team you didn't grow up in that city in the free agency age. But I think Tom Brady is the underdog story of the year. For anybody who says they root for underdogs and all of a sudden they decide they don't like Tom Brady, I'm like, no, you're a bandwagon hopper. I was a Tom Brady fan from the moment he took over for Bledsoe here in Pittsburgh, I believe, actually. That's just a little exciting. Sure, I got a bunch of people who decide, oh man, he was cool until he said that. But
No. I appreciate the love for Brady and the Pats for sure. Not too many people around the country. I don't know why, but it's the success, I think, kind of breeds that resentment. Same thing with the Yankees, but whatever.
I don't know that much about baseball, but I'll say this, man. What Tom Brady has accomplished in the post free agency era is really, I mean, I don't think it's the most impressive feat in pure sports, but I definitely think it's the most impressive feat in the big four American sports, you know, baseball, hockey, football, basketball.
Yeah.
But I think it's more impressive than all those championships they won out there in LA and for basketball.
Yeah, there's actually a chapter 2 in the upcoming book about Brady's work ethic. It's the confidence chapter, where he derives his confidence from. If you look actually into his story a little bit, I know we're kind of wrapping things up here, getting a little off topic, but if you look into his story just a little bit, the guy just overcame one obstacle after another and was doubted time and time again in his life, whether that was middle school, high school, college. Like, everybody overlooked this dude time and time again. He just kept trying and putting in the work, and he had... The reason that he's so successful is not that he had any special gifts at all. Genetically, he's pretty average if you look at him compared to other quarterbacks. But it's just his work ethic that really separated him, put him to that next level. It's an incredible story. But Ed, just wrapping things up, man, what's a last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave our Elite Man audience? It's been a fantastic interview, man. Really appreciate it. And then also a place that our listeners can check out more about your work and your book.
All right, so first, the last message I guess you take away from me. I'm a big believer that if you can change your life in 1 year. I used to say 2 years. Now I think one. If you really want it, you can be in a completely different place. And it may not look like it's a big difference to the outside world, but in terms of your mindset and with the direction you are putting your energy, you can do it, you know, really. And change happens in an instant anyway, and if you get that, you can be whatever or wherever you want to be. In terms of where to find me, my website is just www.edlattimore, my name, .com. My Twitter handle, where I'm super active, Ed Lattimore, at Ed Lattimore, just my name again. Those are the two places you can find me. Instagram is Edward Lattimore. I'm growing Instagram slowly but surely. Still not to the level of my Twitter, but Twitter is just the social medium that that really took off for me, and that's where I cut my teeth, as they say. And my book, you can get it on Amazon.
All right. And the name of the book, too, is?
Not Caring What Other People Think Is a Superpower, Insights from a Heavyweight Boxer.
Love it. Ed, thanks so much for coming on the show, brother. Really do appreciate it. I know our guys are going to love this one, so take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you, man.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.